From Oklahoma to Alabama, Missouri to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court of the United States has ruled that the Biden administration's student loan forgiveness plan is unconstitutional. What happens next? Preston Cooper from the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity is here with the answer. The Biden campaign is attempting to repackage the U.S. economy as a Bidenomics success story. But is it really? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. President Biden likes to compare his student loan forgiveness program to the COVID-era Paycheck Protection Program. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports on why that is a false analogy. And in some states, it is happy fiscal new year for taxpayers as lawmakers have reduced taxes. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Biden's plan to shift billions in student loan obligations to taxpayers has been ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. His plan B likely will suffer the same fate. Preston Cooper is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. He joins us with details. Preston, welcome to American Radio Journal. Preston, for those who may not know the details yet, tell us a bit about the recent ruling from the Supreme Court of the United States. It effectively blocked President Biden's plan to, quote, provide student debt forgiveness. What did the High Court do?
Well, so the Supreme Court in its recent ruling basically said that the Biden administration does not have the authority to forgive student loans en masse through his executive authority alone. Basically, if he wants to do a mass student loan cancellation plan, he has to go to Congress and ask Congress to authorize it. The Supreme Court says that the Biden administration can't just take a 20-year-old law, the HEROES Act, and radically reinterpret it to grant itself the authority to essentially give away $430 billion worth of taxpayer money, which would have been the cost of the student loan forgiveness plan that President Biden had proposed. The Supreme Court said, we're not ruling on the merits of the plan. We're just saying that if you want to do a loan forgiveness plan of this magnitude, you have to go through Congress. And I think that was the right decision.
If you look at the Constitution, which of course is what the justices of the High Court did here, Preston, it is obvious that spending bills, spending efforts must originate in Congress, specifically in the U.S. House of Representatives. Even the president himself initially expressed some doubts that this would work. So why is this really coming as a surprise to anybody? And why is the president attacking it when he himself said he didn't think it would work?
Well, I think it shouldn't be a surprise. I think what the Biden administration was relying on was this idea that nobody might have standing to challenge the loan forgiveness plan. Because if you're going to sue over an executive action, basically you have to show some injury. And so the entities which sued were a group of six states, one of which is Missouri, which owns a loan servicer called Mohila. Mohila would have lost revenue if loans were canceled because it would no longer be servicing those loans. So they said that we have an injury for this reason. And the court's liberals, led by Justice Kagan, were rather skeptical of this rationale for challenging the loan forgiveness program. So I think what the Biden administration hoped was that basically they would get off on this technicality. The case would be thrown out because the states did not have standing to sue. Of course, the court's majority didn't really buy this logic, and they said, no, the states which were challenging the loan forgiveness policy did, in fact, have the authority to challenge it, and as a result, the case was able to proceed to the merits, and the merits said, basically, the Biden administration does not have the authority to forgive student debt. Of course, they're going to try and try again now, and I think they're probably going to see the same results, but we could be here for a while before this is resolved for good.
As you have just indicated, they really haven't learned their lesson. What are they now proposing that really, again, attempts to end-run Congress?
Well, they're proposing to try their loan forgiveness plan through a separate legal authority called the Higher Education Act. And this legal authority, I think most legal scholars would agree, is even weaker than the initial legal authority under which they tried to cancel student debt. And I think that the court issued a pretty broad ruling, which said basically, the Biden administration does not have the authority to enact a loan forgiveness plan of this magnitude, regardless of what legal authority they claim, because this is an issue that should be resolved by Congress. The dollar amounts are simply too large for the executive branch to be making these kinds of decisions. But nonetheless, the Biden administration is going to try again under this separate legal authority. This separate legal authority requires them to go through a formal regulatory process, which will drag out for probably 18 months or more, i.e. beyond the 2024 election. I think the end result will be the same, but I think it's rather cruel to borrowers to basically string them along for 18 more months, not knowing whether the loans are going to get canceled, when the Biden administration has to know at this point there's no way the Supreme Court is going to uphold the loan forgiveness plan in the end.
At the end of the day here, Preston, what we have here, again, is a program, as you pointed out, it's likely destined for the same failure down the road, 18 months, a year or longer, till it is all adjudicated. So is this really not anything more than, in fact, an election ploy? It, of course, was reeled out right before the 2022 elections. We have 2024 elections rapidly approaching. Should we view this as anything other than a political effort?
The first time they attempted to cancel student loans, you might be able to give them a little bit of leeway because they might say, oh, well, this is an unprecedented legal case. We don't know how the court is going to rule. But now they know exactly how the court is going to rule in the second attempt at loan forgiveness in the end. But they're trying it anyway. So I really don't see any other rationale for it other than an election ploy that they're trying. President Biden wants to run in 2024 as the loan cancellation candidate to try and get people to vote for him because he's promising to cancel their loans. He knows in the end that he's not going to be able to do it, but he wants to give borrowers false hope anyways. And I think that there's really no other interpretation than this is an election ploy.
Of course, now the appropriate way to do this, as has been pointed out by the Supreme Court of the United States, and which really everybody knows anyhow, if they were to truly admit it, is to run this proposal, run this program through the Congress of the United States. Is anybody, in fact, attempting to do that? And if they did, would it get very far in Congress?
Well, I don't think it would get very far in Congress. I think that most Republicans are pretty opposed to the loan forgiveness plan on principle, and I think they have make some very good points that this is a plan that would probably mostly help wealthy borrowers, and it would also create a moral hazard, an expectation of future loan forgiveness. So that might lead students to borrow more, and that might lead colleges to charge more because they know students are willing to borrow at higher amounts. So I don't think it's really a good idea, even beyond the legal question. But and for that those reasons, I don't think it's going to go very far in Congress. I also think that if we are talking about student loans and what to do about them, there are other things that Congress can do to make this less of a problem. When it comes right down to it, if you think that loan forgiveness is necessary, it doesn't really make sense that the Congress is going to authorize $1 trillion in new student loans over the coming decade, which is what the Congressional Budget Office estimates we're going to issue in new student loans over the next 10 years.
We have been talking with Preston Cooper. Preston is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. We've been talking about President Biden's proposed student loan, quote, forgiveness program, which has now been struck down by the Supreme Court of the United States. Tell us a little bit about the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, and where can folks go on the web to learn more?
Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank focused on advancing public policies that will create opportunity for those who least have it. The foundation can be reached at freeopp.org. That's freeopp.org, freeopp.org.
Preston Cooper from the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Preston, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth. They, of course, are keeping an eye on everything that's happening in the nation's capital and politically around the country. Scott, always good to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be back, Long. Thank you.
President Biden is trying to do a little bit of a rebranding, if you will, relative to his economic agenda and to the performance of the economy, Scott, actually, since he's become president of the United States, called Bidenomics, and he thinks it's a good and positive thing. What sort of spin is the president putting on this?
President Biden is basically taking credit for the dramatic number of jobs that we lost at the beginning of COVID and the fact that millions of people have returned to work. It's not new job creation, but it's sort of getting the economy back to close to where it was in terms of our labor force participation. It's still definitely way below where we were in the peak of the Trump boom, the Trump economic boom. But Biden's out there talking about low unemployment. He's talking about the gains that they think that they're making in the number of jobs created. But when you think that government creates jobs, the reality is that this gets back to that top line message that Barack Obama used to use with "you didn't build that," and that you needed the government's help in order to do anything in your life. And that's just not the fundamental premise when it comes to entrepreneurism and risk-taking, business formation, investment, all the real economic factors that play in to growing the economy. On one hand, we know that government can thwart the production of new jobs and hurt productivity and hurt wage growth through tax and economic and trade policies and other economic issues. But in this instance, I think what we're seeing really is Biden trying to test some different messages related to the economic situation in America in relation to his reelection bid for 2024.
Well, Jim Carville, as we all know, once famously said, "It's all about the economy, stupid." And President Biden obviously understands that the economy is going to play an important role here, Scott, in his reelection campaign. But isn't this a little bit like putting lipstick on a pig? If you look at what's happened over the last two and a half years, talk a little bit about the impact of inflation, Scott. What impact is this runaway inflation having on the family?
I think that when everybody's sitting down at the dining room table, whether it was over Independence Day or if it's just a typical Tuesday morning in America, we understand that the cost of everything has increased in an enormous way underneath Biden inflation. And we've also got a looming Biden recession that's out there. Now, this message that Biden wants to test on Bidenomics, he's going to totally ignore how the cost of eggs has increased. He's going to say that he cut the cost of gasoline, even though we know gasoline is about $1.50 more expensive nationally than it was when Biden took office. What he's doing is he's taking the worst economic situation that we've had in really 4.5 decades. And as things have slightly improved over the last year, he says, "Look at me, I'm saving the economy, I'm doing all these great things." And the economic pain is definitely being felt everywhere. I mean, when you think about energy costs in America, it's very much due to the regulatory and executive order policies that the Biden administration has been taking that took us from energy independence to an energy crisis. And I think that when you think about all the goods that are transported throughout America, whether it's through trucks or through planes or through our shipping, we know that costs are exacerbated because of the energy crisis today. And that gets passed along to consumers in the cost of goods and services that are being transported. And so that's why when you go to the grocery store, instead of filling up the cart all the way, you're filling it up half the way or even less. That's why when you go to the gas pump, it's not costing $35, it's costing $50. And when we take into consideration that wages are way behind the massive increase that we've had in inflation, and I think I've said this before on the show, inflation is at about 17.8% since March 2020, the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. So unless you have received nearly 18% wage growth increases, you're worse off today than you were just a few years ago at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. And so when people think about 2024 and what the economic vision is, whether it's from Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, Vivek Ramaswamy, Mike Pence, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, any of these folks that want to be the Republican nominee, we need to be asking, how are we able to grow the economy in a way that restores the opportunity and prosperity for the next generation that we've all enjoyed? I don't think anybody wants to leave the next generation worse off than the current generation, at least from the political right. Now, the political left, I think, has been fundamentally trying to change us from a free market, economic, capitalist country to one that constrains risk-taking and entrepreneurism and shares the wealth through economic socialism, I think that that's a recipe for disaster. I think that it creates disincentives to work. And ultimately, when you tax people more, don't expect them to take more risk to grow the economy. And the tax and regulatory regimes of the Biden administration and of the Biden agenda, that's the true legacy, I think, of Bidenomics.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, let's end by having you tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
Well, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Anybody can visit our website, clubforgrowth.org, and sign up to become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Does one government boondoggle program justify another? President Biden thinks it does. For details, we turn now to Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
The U.S. Supreme Court might have struck down President Joe Biden's plan to forgive large amounts of federal student debt, but the president says he's still going to find ways to do it and to make taxpayers likely pay for it. In fact, much of Biden's rhetoric after last week's big Supreme Court decision suggests that student loan forgiveness has really always been more about electoral politics than serious policymaking, despite the huge price tag that's attached to it. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. I know on the program here we've already covered some of what Biden has talked about as the next steps after last week's Supreme Court ruling. So we're going to step a little bit past that here, and instead I'm going to take a close look in this segment at the kind of incoherent logic that's underpinning much of the Biden administration's push for student loan forgiveness, including not just the plan that got struck down by the Supreme Court, but kind of the way in which Biden has framed this entire effort. And a lot of it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. One thing in particular that I think we have to take a look at is the fact that the administration, and this is something they did in the past too, but something that Biden did after last week's Supreme Court ruling, they keep making this, I think, completely faulty comparison between student loan forgiveness and the Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP program, that was a temporary loan forgiveness program for businesses during the pandemic. Now, let's be very clear about one thing here. The PPP program was a total mess. In fact, just last week, we found out from a new Inspector General report at the Small Business Administration that somewhere around $200 billion was stolen by fraudsters from the PPP program and another associated pandemic relief program that the Small Business Administration was responsible for. According to some independent estimates, about one-third of the money spent through the Paycheck Protection Program, only one-third of the money, I should say, actually went to workers who would have otherwise lost their jobs. Another review by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis found that taxpayers were on the hook for roughly $4 of every $1 that was actually spent on preserving people, keeping people on payroll, which is what the program was designed to do. This is, to put it mildly, not the kind of government program that should serve as a model for other policies. You should never, under any circumstances, say, hey, we have to do this thing because we did paycheck protection, and that was such a success. It wasn't. It wasn't a success. And yet, advocates for student loan forgiveness, including Biden, but lots of other people too, keep bringing up this argument as if one bad government program justifies another expensive government program. But even if the PPP wasn't a total disaster, the comparison just doesn't make much sense. For one thing, the loans that were discharged during the pandemic were a temporary measure for an unexpected emergency, and they were intended to make whole individuals who were put out of work, people who would have otherwise been laid off. And those people were put out of work or threatened with layoffs in no small part because the government, maybe not the federal government, maybe state and local governments, but governments in general, were forcing businesses to close due to the pandemic. And as you're probably aware, the government does not force anyone to take a student loan. Now, in fairness, the federal government does subsidize student loans to such an intense degree that it creates really bad incentives for borrowers, but that's certainly different from forcing people out of work and then attempting to make them whole. Additionally, the loans that were handed out by the Paycheck Protection Program and subsequently forgiven were a temporary thing. So if you're going to make this analogy to student debt relief, then the government would also have to stop handing out discounted student loans that have warped the marketplace and created this whole mess. And in fact, that would be a great idea. The government should stop doing that. But that's not happening. Instead, the combination of student loan relief and the other changes that Biden has announced in terms of how future loan repayment will happen is going to do the exact opposite. Rather than being a temporary program providing short-term relief for people that goes away after the crisis has ended, Biden's policies are only going to make the student loan crisis worse. They create the incentives for schools to hike tuition even further than they already have. And they create new incentives for borrowers to take out loans that they're never going to pay back. For example, take a look at Biden's income-based repayment plan, which is something that the Department of Education finalized on Friday, actually just after the Supreme Court's ruling in that much more highly publicized case. Now, this new repayment program means that most borrowers will never have to pay more than 5% of their monthly discretionary income in student loan payments. Additionally, outstanding student loan balances will be forgiven after 10 years for those who borrow $12,000 or less, and a maximum payment period of 20 years for anyone else, no matter how much they borrowed. It means that a lot more loans will never be fully paid back. In fact, the Brookings Institution estimates that on average, borrowers will only be expected to repay approximately 50 cents for every dollar they borrow under Biden's plan. Brookings also warns that Biden's income-based repayment plan will result in tuition inflation with increased borrowing, particularly by students who are pursuing low-value, low-earning degrees. The Department of Education says that Biden's income-based repayment program will cost about $138 billion over 10 years, but its projections don't take into account the increased demand for student loans that is likely to result from the fact that Biden is making those loans so much cheaper for most borrowers. The Congressional Budget Office says the real price tag will be almost twice as much, $230 billion, and the Wharton Budget Model, an independent group at the University of Pennsylvania, says it'll be even more expensive, $360 billion. The only way any of this makes sense is to understand that student loan forgiveness, all of this stuff that gets stuffed into the student loan forgiveness box, has always been more about politics than policy. It's a taxpayer-subsidized handout to college-educated Americans, a group that, of course, generally votes Democratic. And it's a convenient wedge issue for Biden to use in hackneyed attacks against Republicans, like last week when he said that the Supreme Court had literally snatched from the hands of millions of Americans thousands of dollars in student debt relief. Of course, what's left unsaid there is that it was the president who was putting that money in their hands in the first place and doing it unconstitutionally. The Biden administration may have lost at the Supreme Court last week, but the defeat clearly hasn't inspired any reconsideration of a policy that is unnecessary, expensive, and likely ruinous to the next generation of student borrowers. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of that and other big Supreme Court rulings this week at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Tax cuts are making for a happy fiscal new year in a number of states. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council tells us who the lucky taxpayers are on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Happy state fiscal new year. For those who celebrate anyways, in total, 46 of the 50 states started fiscal year 2024 on July 1st. This week also closed the books on most state legislative sessions in what was an incredible 2023 for hardworking taxpayers. In recent years, we've seen significant income tax relief in the states. Notably, 10 states, Kentucky, West Virginia, Montana, Utah, Arkansas, North Dakota, Indiana, Nebraska, Connecticut, and Ohio, have cut personal income taxes in this year alone. With the new addition of West Virginia, North Dakota, and Connecticut this year, the total number of states cutting taxes since 2021 is now at an incredible 24, with several of these states cutting taxes multiple times during that period. Despite economic turmoil caused by COVID-19 pandemic and lockdowns, many states have found themselves flush with cash, especially as their economies begin to reopen. Some of the budget largesse can be directly traced back to trillions of dollars of federal money that were pumped into state economies, some directly infused into state budgets. Of course, states are facing a long-term trap with the so-called free federal aid. As a great economist, Milton Friedman, would always say, there is no such thing as a free lunch. But apart from the federal funds, state tax revenues not only returned to normal, but in most cases even exceeded previous growth trends. Since 2021, most states have seen healthy surpluses fueled by abundant tax revenue, and in many cases are using that surplus to enact substantial tax relief for their taxpayers. Taxpayers in several of the states that have made cuts this year have seen tax relief multiple times in recent years. Ohio and Montana both cut taxes in 2021 and did so again in 2023 this year. Ohio's tax cuts that were signed on Independence Day this year moved the top personal income tax rate to 3.5, down from 3.99 before. And Montana's cuts dropped their personal income tax rate to 5.9, up from 6.5 previously. Utah, Arkansas, and Nebraska have cut taxes in each of the last 3 years, incredibly. Utah's personal income tax rate was reduced down to 4.65, Arkansas's went down to 4.7, and Nebraska's went impressively all the way from 6.84 to eventually phasing in a 3.99% top personal income tax rate. Other states such as West Virginia and North Dakota are joining the flat tax movement or the tax cut movement for the first time since that movement really took off in 2021. West Virginia reduced its income tax by an average of over 20% and flattened their brackets. And North Dakota also flattened their brackets and went to from a top rate of 2.9 down to 2.5. Other states are continuing to reap the benefits of fiscal responsibility by accelerating cuts. Indiana moved up its time frame to get to a 2.9% personal income tax to 2027. That improved by 2 years and improved triggers that could have potentially prevented cuts from being enacted. Kentucky accelerated previous tax cuts as well and put itself on a potential path to full elimination of its personal income tax. The Bluegrass state could become the 10th state with no personal income tax in the country and the first to eliminate it since Alaska all the way back in 1980. It should also be noted that the tax cuts aren't solely relegated to red states. Tax reform is proving to be a bipartisan issue. The Kentucky cuts were signed into law by Democrat Governor Andy Beshear, but perhaps even more astoundingly is the fact that a state in the Northeast, outside of the Live Free or Die state of New Hampshire, also cut taxes. Connecticut, of all places, passed tax cuts through the Democrat-controlled legislature that were signed into law by Democrat Governor Nella DeMont. In most cases, the tax cuts enacted this year, the goal seems to be clear: a fairer, less burdensome tax system that flattens state tax codes as well. As Washington's infamous partisan gridlock continues to inhibit many needed free market reforms that would revitalize our economy and lift real wages for individuals, we can continue to look to the states, our 50 laboratories of democracy, to deliver meaningful tax relief to hardworking taxpayers across America. For more information, please visit alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WMGM-FM and WTKU-FM in Linwood, New Jersey, along with WHAI-FM in Greenfield, Massachusetts. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.